Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, when the store is quiet, I get to chat to my friends about the films and the series that we're loving. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop.
Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV?
How's it?
Hello.
Good morning.
How are you guys?
Yeah, we're fine.
Good, eh? Got my bean there, coffee, my podcast room. I'm happy.
Hey, lekker.
Yeah.
We've got ourselves a Kolsky Matthews here this morning. You are a creative copywriter?
Video copywriter.
Video copywriter.
I think Okay. Everyone's creative.
Okay.
Even though professionally in my business, I'm known as a creative, which kind of kills me slowly.
Okay, video copywriter. Cool, I'll take it. We've got ourselves a Perrin.
Hello.
How are you, my P-dog?
I'm all right, how are you?
Lekker, man. You're a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I do writing, shooting, editing, whatever you need, eh? Plumbing, I'm there, I'm your guy. Painting.
Perrin's the filmmaking equivalent of that, like, kind of Frenchman in the square that's got the... he's got the sort of cymbals on his back and the sort of strings
that
he pulls.
Marching band.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
That sort of one-man band guy.
Yeah.
And my name is Russell. I'm the owner of The Bioscope, which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg. And the three of us, are putting in our time. We're doing our job where we get behind the counter here of the video store and we get a chance to occasionally give people movies, but for the most part we get to talk amongst ourselves about the films and the series that we've been enjoying. I've got some good series to chat to you guys about.
Yeah, same.
Very cool Disney Plus show that's new. Cool. A completion of a really cool Netflix whodunit, which I've mentioned before.
Yes.
The big movies we'll chat about. I want to talk about Sinners, which starts this coming weekend, which I've had a chance to see.
I'm so excited for
I couldn't talk too much about it the last time, because I felt like I'd seen it a little too earlier.
Yeah,
being a cinema owner,
being a cinema owner, but I saw it quite early.
Maybe we can talk about it now because it's coming out this Friday. We can talk about Warfare.
Oh. Yeah,
which is in cinemas at the moment. That's the very cool Alex Garland
and my latent war film. Panic attack.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, I know that we've all got our quirks here at the video store. For me, it's the heartfelt gooeys that we keep talking about. For Cole, you love a good jump scare.
Yes, I love it.
And there is unquestionably one significant one in Warfare, which I'm sure you left your body for.
Yeah, and it'll blow your guts out.
Literally. So we'll get into that and talk about all of that. But we like to kick things off with a little, hey, did you guys see? Which is our little rapid-fire news and entertainment huck.
Yep.
Has anyone got anything juicy
I got a juicy juice.
Oh, do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kolsky, you kick us off.
I got an icy.
A what?
An icy.
What is that?
Yeah, like you got something juicy? You know, icy's from high school?
No.
Trying to make it an adjective.
Did you not have icy's in high school?
I think I'm a little bit older than you guys.
No way.
No, I remember, did they ban them at your school as well?
No, they didn't.
What? Okay. It's a thing. What is it?
So it's, remember icy's? So they're like fruit pouches frozen.
It's like fruit juice frozen, but it's in like this little rectangular plastic packets.
Yeah.
And then everyone would have them like fucking melting in their blazer pockets
at
school. And
okay. Like a lollipop thing.
Yeah,
but you guys just called them icy's.
They were girthier. so like
okay,
with the best flavors of mango and orange like together. Oof. But anyway, so I had a cast in grade 8 from literally my ankle to my hip. It was massive. And
what happened?
So I ran down a hill to retrieve a ball and my leg bent the other way.
Oh my God.
And I tore all the ligaments. I got pins on my knees.
I had a friend who had a motorbike accident just before matric holiday.
Oh,
and
shit.
He had a big cast on his leg. He told everyone he got bitten by a shark. In Mshlanga, bro got action.
Really?
All these women are like, "Oh, you the guy who got bitten by a shark?" And he like told the story got more dramatic every time.
Yeah, I had to tell people that I was playing soccer, not retrieving a ball.
But
yeah, so it tore. And then when my dad, when we I was in the car with my leg hanging out going to the hospital. My dad was talking to the guy who helped me, and he closed the leg, the door on my leg.
Oh, God. Okay.
Anyways.
But what's this got to do with ICs?
So, my cast, I used the my ICs. People use my cast as an icy crusher. Because if you crush it on the ground, it would tear the plastic.
Okay.
So eventually, because I had a cast that was unbreakable, smash it, and I wouldn't feel a thing. And it was great business, you know. I didn't get any action for that. But yeah.
Why were we talking about these things?
No, because I tried to make an adjective cool thing out of juicy.
Okay, you've got it.
I said you got some juice.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry.
We've gone all around.
We got a good story out of it.
Okay, we got.
See, this is why we do it.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, so hey, did you guys see that stunts are finally going to be recognized by the Academy Awards?
Hey, that was one of mine. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, same. At the 100th Academy Awards.
In 2028.
Which really sucks because that means we're not going to see Tom Cruise's Mission Impossible get a stunt Oscar.
My God, that is such a good point.
Is it only in 2028?
It bums me out.
Why is it taking so long? Just put it in the next one.
I know.
Why do you need 4 years build up for that?
I don't know.
Maybe because consideration for it hasn't started yet. I don't know.
No, of course, you could do everything within a year.
Yeah, it's bullshit.
You could give away best fucking what next year. And
yeah, because
casting
is next year at the Oscars.
Oh, casting is an Oscar.
Yeah, they added that in before stunts.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, and they've been wanting those two categories for fucking years because casting is at the BAFTAs. It's been at the BAFTAs for ages.
Hey, jeepers.
That's a very interesting one to give casting.
Yeah, because what are the parameters? How do you determine? Oh,
suppose
that's the
like
best
the
casting.
Same as performance.
Yeah,
it's just like
because the thing is, people don't realize.
It's arbitrary.
Yeah, and also, but people don't realize what casting directors do. They are fucking good at their jobs because they're supposed to figure out chemistry between actors. They're supposed to figure out, cool, these actors look like these actors, so they should play the mother and daughter. But they need to get along, and they help them get there. So, with casting directors are, so important because they start setting up that chemistry before the film actually starts. You know what I mean?
But
in the auditioning phase, at least.
I don't know, because the director will come in and veto whatever the casting director
says.
Yeah,
but it's casting director. I've worked with casting directors before, and they do so much, especially
in auditions.
They
do a lot of admin. They do a lot of, like they'll go through the, whenever you hear, thousands of kids were auditioned.
Yeah, but
they did that, but
trust me, there's been incidences where I've sat in on auditions and you think you've got someone and the casting director's like, let's try X, Y, and Z, and then you realize you don't got that person. Okay. Obviously, a director directs, right? But a casting director also helps you find that X factor within that actor.
Yeah, I was about to say, because the director will sit over everyone else in the crew.
Yeah.
And, of course, also veto for their vision.
Yeah.
But it just feels like this one. You're right. No, they do a lot of work.
Yeah, so it's. I mean, it's like producers. People think they just get the money. They do a lot more.
No,
than
they
just
literally do.
The money.
They literally do everything.
They drive the ship. You know, they allow the director to have the fucking cabin to do what he needs to do. You know what
no,
I mean?
No. Of course, no. There's no question about producer for me. It's just whether or not the casting director is a creative skill.
Yeah.
As much as it is an admin person.
Well, I think
for me to
figure out. It'll be an interesting thing to see because then people can start also digging into, wait, why is a casting director up for an Oscar? You know what I mean? So because I mean, you look at films like Anora, for instance. The casting is phenomenal in that because it's also about finding the right people, not just finding people. You know what I mean?
No, I get it. Yeah. No, that's cool. Okay, but then stunts come in many years' time.
Yeah.
And I think that was largely advocated by Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, for
when they did The Fall Guy.
Yeah, I know Tom Cruise has been advocating it for years as well.
That to me makes a lot of sense because there's a very physical craft that you can see in front of you.
Yeah.
Just like the person who stitched the dress that wins the award for best wardrobe.
Yeah.
So is the people that have coordinated the sequence that will earn it a craft award.
Yeah.
That's what I feel about with the casting. Like, is it as much of a craft?
Yeah.
I guess it is, yeah.
No, I'm very happy that that's going to be introduced because, it's cool. Been at the SAGs for years as well, so, yeah.
Okay.
Anyways.
Hey, did you guys see the trailer for The Phoenician Scheme?
Yes.
Oh, is this the new Wes Anderson?
This is the new Wes Anderson, which we've now got.
What do you think? Because I know Wes Anderson is like a big guy for you.
I think I was when I discovered Life Aquatic and Darjeeling and all those movies, I found a guy that had a sensibility that I loved, that sort of kooky, weird, out of the mold, or creates his own mold. I have seen him slowly crawl further and further up his own ass.
I agree.
I think the last time we had a semblance of something heartfelt and real was Grand Budapest.
I agree.
Mm. Thereafter, it got more and more pretentious.
Yeah.
So here's hoping we see some sunlight. But it looks cool. And it's very Bioscope. And I'm the most excited about this one because since our upgrade at the beginning of last year, we are now able to screen these movies, which we've been doing at the Bioscope for now.
Yeah. So it'll be over a year. So this will be your first Wes Anderson.
Exactly. So this will be my first Wes Anderson.
You didn't even get Asteroid City.
No, we hadn't upgraded by then. We'd started the podcast, and that's when I was realizing, fuck, I am missing out on all these movies.
Yes.
Fuck. What do I need to do? And then I finally was able to not only afford, but also just wrap my head around what that upgrade meant and realized it wasn't as overwhelming. It was still very overwhelming, but not as overwhelming. But yeah, we've got what seems to be Benicio del Toro in more of the main role. There's a lot of plane crashes. There's a nun. And there's a very kooky Michael Cera.
Yeah.
Who plays this like weird German guy. So it looks cool. I think what the trailer's not showing us is what is very Wes Anderson, at least in the last three movies, which is like the narratives. This is a layer within a layer within a layer, which is very fucking annoying and completely unnecessary. And I've got a sneaky suspicion we're going to get the exact same thing.
So my issue with Wes Anderson lately is I just feel they're very cold and empty. There's no heart to it, like you said, with Grand Budapest. For me, my favorite era of Wes Anderson was when he was writing with Owen Wilson.
Yeah, were pointing that out.
Yeah, that was pre-Grand Budapest, Grand Budapest and before that. We were like top, especially Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums. Bottle Rocket is great as well.
Yeah, I've got a feeling we should screen Bottle Rocket.
Yeah, it's a Bioscope goodie.
Because it's definitely one of the ones that most people haven't seen.
Do you my problem with Wes Anderson as well is it feels like every trailer I see now feels like an SNL skit. It feels like AI slapped it together. You
know I feel the same way. Yeah,
I mean, and to be honest, like he's still no one makes films like him. You've got lots of imitators, especially in the advertising community. Everyone just wants everything to look like Wes Anderson. And his art direction is on point every single time. His films look amazing, but it just gets to a point where it's just lifeless. It's just a picture with nothing to say. And that's what I thought about Asteroid City.
Having that heart is just so key.
Yeah.
And it's so subtle. And I don't know whether Owen Wilson is involved in the writing of some of the other movies that he does, because often you find it's just got so much heart. Like a movie like Wedding Crashers, as stupid as it is, there's like just these like little nuggets that you hold on to. Even the internship where they go and they work in Google, like there's fucking heart.
Yeah.
And as dumb as that movie is, it just pins you down throughout the movie where you're like, I'm in. I'm
bought into this.
But that's what the importance of co-writers, eh? Like you often see some of like Tarantino, people forget that his best work was with the co-writer. That's with Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, you know? Like
when you listen to that What Went Wrong podcast, which is such a great podcast, how these movies get made, you realize with Star Wars that George Lucas's wife did so much in terms of like editing from a more objective point of view. And when he was left alone to make episode one, it was a fuck show.
Yeah.
Because he was fucking all on his own.
Coppola as well. Great examples of people where you have to rein them in to get the best out of them.
And I think the life lesson is you need your friends.
Exactly. You do need your friends.
You need your friends for even just life, not even making movies here, guys.
Yeah.
That becomes your ex-wife later. You need her.
You've got to have some people to bounce some things off. I started adopting that with the Bioscope really quite a while ago, where I was like, this can't just be what the movies Russell loves.
Yeah,
like, I need other people that are telling me what to screen and what to do. And when left alone, obviously, I'm the one that's ultimately got to fill the gap, but...
Yeah, 100%.
I've at least consciously tried. And I even chat to you guys often where I'm like, what should we do? What could be good? Because fuck, can't just be up to me.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, Phoenician Scheme, sorry, 30th of May, cool. We'll screen at the Bioscope. Let's fucking do this.
Hey, did you guys see the official lineup for Cannes dropped?
Yes.
Very
that
excited.
That was one of mine as well.
Yeah, so notable, one, people were surprised that a few entries were left out, namely Spike Lee out of the main competition, but he's screening his film The Highest Low out of competition, which is a remake of the Kurosawa film High and Low,
yeah,
which I'm very hesitant about because normally I love Spike Lee, but how he handled the Old Boy remake, which is, in my opinion, the worst remake I've ever seen.
Never seen it.
I'm never going to watch it.
So Old Boy was an adaptation of a manga, right?
Mm.
And his adaptation wasn't, because a lot of the times people mistake remakes for remakes. They think, oh, it's a remake of something, but often it's just an adaptation, a new adaptation of the source material.
Yes.
It's like True Grit. The Coen Brothers film isn't a remake of the John Wayne film. It's an adaptation of the novel. Right?
That's what I was trying to say when we were talking about American Psycho. It's like,
yeah,
they're not remaking the movie with Christian Bale.
Adaptation.
It's a new adaptation of the book we all know.
Yeah, yes. Same as Solaris with Tarkovsky and Soderbergh. Right?
George Clooney. Yeah.
Yeah, I prefer the Soderbergh one, actually.
It's a controversial.
Yeah, it's got my favorite music soundtrack of all time. Incredible score. Anyways.
Let's check that.
So, yeah, I'm nervous about that because it's not, because High and Low was an adaptation of a novel called The King's Ransom, I think. And the Kurosawa film is a classic. It's fucking phenomenal.
So good, dude.
It's so good.
It's like also some of the best cinematography ever.
Yeah, it's incredible. Mm. Just the character dilemmas in that film are just phenomenal. But then the Spike Lee version isn't an adaptation of the book, which is an American novel. It's an adaptation of the film. So I'm nervous about that.
Okay.
But Spike Lee...
He's nervous.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm still going to see it. But I mean, this lineup... shut up.
I just love your emotions around cinema.
Yeah, around movies. I'm so nervous about this.
Fuck you guys.
No, but sorry, I want to interject for something. I think... It's maybe worth just chatting. I don't know whether you guys know, but with Cannes, obviously the main thing is the fact that it is a film festival where these films are, there's a handful of films that are in competition.
Yeah.
This means they are there for the Palme d'Or.
The main prize, yeah.
And the main prizes.
Yeah.
And then there are films that do screen that are out of competition.
Yeah.
And what that means is they just want a big Cannes screening because this is a great platform for everyone to be seen.
Oh, like
on
Mission
the
Impossible.
French Riviera.
Yeah, that's screening, yeah.
And so what was so exciting for me in 2011 when I went, and the one and only time I've ever gone to Cannes,
so jealous,
is we watched that, well, we didn't get to watch it there, but we watched the premiere. We were on the sides for Midnight in Paris. So it was like
Woody Allen,
but it was like De Niro was there and like Banderas and Selma
Hayek. Antonio Banderas.
So a lot of them like just want to be there. So you I don't know whether it's a snub if you weren't in competition and you're now out of competition.
Yeah.
You might have not wanted to put yourself up for the scrutiny.
Yeah.
And it could have been a choice.
Yeah,
I don't think you want to necessarily be in competition. You want to just screen at Cannes.
And Mark Kermode wrote, is a great film critic. He's one of my favorites. He wrote a great piece on why he hates Cannes, like actually attending. And he says it's just the most toxic, like, environment to, like, go watch movies. Because what I hate about Cannes is that it's part of the culture to boo films relentlessly if you don't like it even a little bit. So, like... The French will just boo until their throats hurt at a movie that they don't like. And then 20-minute fucking standing ovations. Fuck off. Even just
pathetic.
clapping for 2 minutes is fucking... Clapping for 30 seconds is like, okay, enough.
It gets uncomfortable. I never felt any booing. What I witnessed, which was incredible, and this is a nice little segue, is there was a movie called Skern Hate.
Yeah.
Which is beauty. And it was made by Oliver Hermanis.
He's screening this year.
That's my segue.
Oh, shit.
It's fine. It's good.
Oliver Hermanis is fantastic.
And Skern Hate involves homosexuality within the sort of more conservative Afrikaans community. And there's a couple of these scenes that are like quite difficult to watch.
Yeah.
Quite explicit, quite, you know, sort of big hairy men. sort of going for it in the sort of behind closed doors.
Yeah.
And I watched the audience sort of slowly get up and walk out through some of these uncomfortable scenes. But I never felt the booing. But it's definitely an exciting place. I'll never forget running across the sort of main square at about 8 in the morning for Art House Cinema.
So cool.
Because Melancholia was screening. And
Jesus.
And we'd gotten tickets to be in that screening.
Did you see Tree of Life as well?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I love how you know it was the same year.
Did you get a glimpse of Terrence Malick? Because he's very, like, he doesn't
wasn't there.
Appear anywhere.
He wasn't there.
I remember for the longest time, Terrence Malick, no one knew what he looked like. The only reference we had was he had a cameo in the film Badlands. He's like a door-to-door salesman in it.
Yeah.
And
there was a photo that was in the catalog, which was a very, like, old photo.
Yeah.
And I just find it amazing that these people can disappear like that.
Well, I mean, I remember with...
Because he would have had to be on... It's not like he's an artist that sort of lives in a cabin and then emails his work.
Yeah.
It's like he had to interact with hundreds of people.
I
just love how no one's got a photo of the
dude. Yeah, it's on The Thin Red Line when he was nominated for Best Director at the Oscars. I remember there, because they have the pictures of the directors. For him, it was literally just a picture of a seat with his name on it. Because they're like, where the fuck is this guy? Anyways... Yeah.
We are digressing. But Oliver Hermanus is a fantastic South African filmmaker who is just doing so well.
Yeah.
He had a film that was nominated for an Oscar a while ago.
Yeah.
Living with the Bill Nighy.
Yeah.
It was one of the smaller ones about 2 years ago.
Yeah, it was a remake of Ikiru.
That we didn't really sort of chat about. But he just keeps going. He's got a movie called The History of Sound.
Yeah, it's another
that is in competition
kick-ass name
this year. That movie Skoonheid, which is fucking incredible. It's honestly one of the best South African films I've ever seen.
Yeah.
He won the Queer Palm.
He won the queer category at Venice for, I don't know if I'm allowed to say the word.
Morphe.
Yeah.
No, you can. Okay.
You can say it. It's the name of the movie. You're not using it as a slur.
I fucking love that film.
I've never got to see. Morphe.
It's incredible.
And sort other.
It's one of the best boot camp, quote unquote boot camp films I've seen.
Yeah.
And obviously, I mean, it's another queer film, obviously, in the title. But yeah, History of Sound, Josh O'Connor, Paul Mescal. Yes.
Oh, Paul Mescal.
Yeah. Oh, those two are in this one.
Yeah. So do you know what it's about?
No.
So it's about two men, their relationship in the early 1900s. They like are with each other in like the English countryside, and then they like start to write folk songs based on the folk songs they heard on the road or something.
Okay.
That's like a very vague description.
They're lovers.
Yeah. I think it turns into that.
Okay.
So Josh O'Connor with another, just those two are just churning out queer bangers.
Yeah, literally.
queer bangers.
But other films that have been announced, Eddington by Ari Aster, I'm very excited about, which is a Western black comedy, apparently. Pedro Pascal.
The poster got announced, and it's these bison that are going down a hill and like falling off the hill. But this is good old Ari Aster, who I will forever associate with Cole, because in our movie-going days... together, we Cole was like, we got to go see Midsommar, and I was like, what's it about?
His best film.
Oh, that's when we accidentally walked into Men in Black.
Yeah, they were in the got the movies wrong or something. We were like, what the fuck? But no,
it's
you
his best film,
you introduced me to Ari Aster.
I remember
that day when
they were just come boy, let's go watch a movie together.
Yeah. No, this was a great friendship. Where the moment I'm met Cole, I was like, hey, if you ever need someone to watch movies with, I'll be your guy. I'll be your movie guy.
And the first movie we watched was The Meg.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
We formed
Jason Statham.
We formed our friendship over that. Wes Anderson's Phoenician Scheme is in competition, which
is interesting. So other notable directors, Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne, the brothers, they are great filmmakers. They've got one of their films up there. Alpha by Julia Dacanau, who won for Titane a few years ago at Cannes. I'm fucking excited for that. I love...
It's nice to watch that.
Titane is one of the great films I've seen of the past 20 years.
I'm very fascinated by that film.
The premise,
Cole, of Titane is a woman who has sex with a car.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
gets pregnant.
Yeah. But that's
what, she gets pregnant?
That's on the surface. So,
I know there's more.
Something more.
It's a surprisingly, so it's a horror film, but it's a surprisingly sweet and tender film. So did you watch Raw? You watch Raw?
No.
Raw is incredible as well. So it's about a girl who goes to a veterinary school, but in the hazing ceremony where they have to like eat like rabbit kidneys and stuff, she becomes a cannibal. Like, she gets a taste for human flesh.
And
she becomes a cannibal. It's fucking incredible. Other films.
Wow, I love empathy for cannibals.
Bones and All. Did you watch Bones and All?
No, I didn't.
Unbelievable. Luca Guadagnino, one of my favorite films. Okay, sorry, Richard Linklater's new movie, New Wave, very excited about that.
Nouvelle Vague.
Yeah.
That's what it's called, it's not called New Wave.
Oh, that's what it says on the Cannes website.
Yeah, it says Nouvelle Vague.
Okay, well, I like the pretentious one better. Okay.
Yeah.
And then Kelly Reichardt's got a new film. Joachim Trier, who won he didn't win for Worst Person in the World a few years ago, which was my favorite film of that year. Incredible movie. And then In Curtain Regard, that's the debut filmmakers category.
Is that how you pronounce it?
I butchered it, definitely.
That's the sort of B-team competition.
Yeah, Scarlett Johansson's directorial debut.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, so it'll be cool.
En certain regard.
Yeah. Out of competition, obviously, Highest to Lowest and Mission Impossible are the biggies there.
Yeah, boy.
I'm excited for Mission Impossible.
Oh, yes. Did you see the new trailer?
Yeah.
And the new trailer basically references all of the old movies. So it's like this culmination.
It looks
And it's even where, crazy. Like, you remember when he did the descent down into the vault?
Iconic scene.
Yeah, that was Mission Impossible 1.
And there's a knife that drops on the table.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then he's holding the knife in the final reckoning. You're like, why is the fucking knife important?
How do you still have the knife?
Yeah, who like, someone was like, Ethan Hunt used this knife, I'm going to keep it.
Yeah.
Like, what's... I don't get it. Anyways.
No, that trailer looks amazing. Milkshake from Severance, isn't it? Milkshake. We call him Milkshake.
Milkshake.
it looks crazy. There's a stunt I know that he apparently passed out like 5 times doing. I think it's
probably diving to the submarine.
Yeah. But it looks fucking nuts. We can.
But in terms of other, in the uncertain regard,
uncertain.
Harris Dickinson has a movie.
Oh, yeah. I didn't see the name there. I forgot that he was
Harris Dickinson?
He was in Triangle of Sadness, Baby Girl.
Isn't he playing John Lennon?
Iron Claw.
He's going to be John Lennon.
Yeah.
Okay. So is he directing?
Yeah.
He directed this movie.
I love Harris Dickinson. I think he's even though he's blowing up, he's still weirdly underappreciated. I think he's fucking phenomenal.
There's a nice
Beach Rats. He's amazing in Beach Rats.
There's a nice new era of cool young actors coming through, and you can feel a new wave.
Yeah.
Oh, that Beatles movie is like the casting of all like the hottest British actors in Hollywood at the moment, basically.
Sham, don't call the Irish British. They'll fucking kick you.
Oh, this is actually a good point. Sorry. Sorry, Barry.
And Paul. I saw a funny joke of that where I think it was an Onion headline where it was like, Sam Mendes only found out about TV after announcing the Beatles movie like
happening.
Yeah, because he could have just done a season of these shows. But I'm excited for that because it's going to be done from different perspectives.
Isn't Sam Mendes also doing that? I think it's Sam Mendes doing the Mussolini series.
Yeah, well, he must focus on one thing. So this Beatles movie is 4 movies.
Yeah, so it's going to be told from, so it's the same event all told from their own perspectives, which is a great idea.
That makes sense. So it's an editing exercise.
Yeah.
Provided they get all the coverage, they can shoot it in one go.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes some sense. Do you know what part of the Beatles story it'll be in?
I have no idea. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
They must keep that hidden. That sounds like a cool...
Yeah, it's a great idea. It's a really great idea. It could either flop or go fucking phenomenally. You know what I mean?
Interesting that it had to be those 4 movies.
Mm. Well, I mean, I think it's cool because it gives each of them their own like perspective. Because people would be like, oh, it's obviously going to be about Paul and John. You know, it's not going to be about Ringo or George Harrison. You know, so yeah.
No, but interesting.
Yeah, it goes.
speaking of all these hot in-demand actors, the guy who's playing George Harrison in this Beatles movie that we're talking about is in Warfare. Can we talk about Warfare now?
Yes.
There's my segue.
Wait, who's playing? Oh, Josh.
It's Joseph Quinn.
Joseph Quinn, yeah.
Yeah, the worst part about Warfare is that you had to watch poor Joseph Quinn screaming for like an hour.
Yeah,
for a long time.
Yeah, we saw that guy. Shame. It's not appropriate, but we saw Dong.
Yeah, I got to tell you about that.
Because I was going to turn to you like, does this make the list? We saw Dong when they.
I couldn't tell the difference between like cut open leg and dong, to be honest. I was like focusing on the gaping wound.
Okay, what kind of a gay are you? Just saying.
Okay, hold on. Context. This movie we're going to talk about now is Warfare. This is a film about a Navy SEAL sniper operation. Is it Iraq or Afghanistan?
Iraq.
It's Iraq.
Yeah, 2006.
It's in Ramadi, Iraq.
Yeah. And it's all set over the course of this one afternoon where this American sort of Navy sniper team is monitoring this building. They have to do an operation. Everything goes pear.
Yeah. Right?
So that's the basic they get
discovered,
context. Yeah. And we're going to talk about all the nuance of this movie and what makes it special. But I get these emails often from the distributors where they've updated us on the Film and Publication Board's age restriction. And the moment I get that, I've got to obviously update the listing on our site.
Yeah.
And I actually saw that part of the age restriction involved nudity. And I actually went back to the distributor. I was like, when did we see any nudity? Like, then I thought maybe the exposed guts of the dude or the wounds. But I was like, but that's violence.
Yeah.
Why would they classify that as nude? And he's like, hold on. He goes, yeah, you're right. Let me double check.
Yeah.
And he got the official FPB sort of feedback
like
where they were like, no, you see his exposed genitals. And I was like, I don't remember seeing
this. I'm going to go back and watch it.
To be honest, it's blink and you miss. And it's also silly to kind of have it there, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Like to qualify that as nudity. But like, whenever you see a peen in a movie, they lose their shit.
It's amazing. Eh? Like a nipple sort of nothing. But the moment you see the dong, it's like, okay, no, this is serious.
Yeah. Oh, this is serious.
We've all got our quirks.
It's up to objectify women. We cannot objectify men.
Yeah,
that's the heteronormative world for you. Thanks, FBB.
We've all got our quirks. As we said, Cole loves a good jump scare, which is something we can talk about now.
Are you going to say, with Perrin loves a good dong?
Perrin, when we
rolls
chose,
reversed, eh?
Well, listen, you pulled it out now.
Yeah, sorry. No, because me and Cole are...
Figuratively speaking.
Me and Cole need to do our 3-hour dong episode.
The fact that you want to do that tells me that this is something that's on your mind.
It's always so exciting because it is taboo. It's kind of like a jump scare.
But that's
the appeal.
I think for someone that...
We're not allowed to do this.
Yeah. I think for someone that loves cinema as much as you, that thinks about cinema as much as you, that is almost a little desensitized.
Yeah.
I think there's a funny quirk behind why this is the one thing that you, occasionally
latch onto
is because it is so remarkably different that, one sees a male genitalia.
I mean, I think it's changed recently. But I mean, the thing with, especially in America, the moment a penis is on screen, it's immediate NC-17, which is the worst rating your film could get because it affects your box office numbers. Because R is like our 16. Like as long as you have an adult present,
interesting.
You can take a 14-year-old.
What happens with boobies?
That's R mainly. Vagina and boobs. Like very rarely you get NC-17. Very rarely.
So. Okay,
it has to be extended.
R
like,
is less than NC-17.
NC-17 is basically R-18. Remember when the R18 was a thing?
I remember 2 to 21. That's how fucking old I am.
Jesus,
2 to 21.
There was always the sort of wording when I was a little kid: 2 to 18, 2 to 16, as in like under 2, you actually don't know what the fuck's going on.
Oh right.
So you would be okay watching 7.
You're not.
But I remember. I significantly remember walking in and out of Four Ways Mall, seeing the posters for 7, and it being like, "This is 2 to 18."
I do not remember that. Got to
sneak into that.
But we had a 21. in the sort of that must have late been like 80s, early 90s.
Pre-94
Well, I mean, so in America, before PG, PG-13, all that, X was like the R.
Yes.
So Midnight Cowboy is the first X-rated film to win Best Picture at the Oscars.
Yeah, the South African movie Indaba.
Yes.
Yeah. In that moment
wound,
when they,
right?
yeah, when they yeah. were trying to get it out of cinemas, they lobbied for it to be an X-rated film.
I remember there were
and there was a brief moment where it was classified as explicit porn. And everyone was like
absolute bullshit.
Everyone was like, "You morons, you gave it 16
yeah.
a couple of months ago and now all of a sudden it's X-rated. Fuck off. You're a joke." So. And it was because the conservative Tosa community and a whole bunch of politicians were lobbying for it to not be screened.
Yeah, because they felt it was exposing like traditional
the community,
secrets.
The conservative community can get fucked.
But there was this lovely moment where I was like, okay, Stuart Kinnickel can't turn this ship around. But I phoned the distributor and I was like, what do I need to do to qualify as an X-rated cinema?
Yeah.
Because maybe I can do this.
Yes.
And then we can screen the movie. Like, how cool could that be that I turn into this?
It's a real punk rock moment.
Yeah. And she was like, no, you need blacked windows, you need certain entrances, and you need like certain things.
Crazy.
But I was like, let me classify myself as a porn cinema just for a month.
Yeah, just for that.
Like, what can we do? Like, this is so interesting.
Yeah.
And I even said, like, here's a dumb idea. Yeah. Why don't we screen this movie in sex shops?
Yeah.
No, totally, dude. Be creative.
But she was like, no, we got to wade this out and fight it. Like, we got to do the right thing. But I was like, how cool could it be if we just fucking, like, did this thing?
Yeah.
Anyways, Warfare is incredible.
Yeah.
I think it's worth mentioning that what makes this movie special and different is the fact that it is aiming and very successfully achieves being the most accurate war movie you could watch.
I agree. I think it's the best desert warfare film that I've seen.
And the
I like the
reason
niche qualification
yeah.
there
and the reason
no,
for
yeah,
it,
desert warfare. Yeah,
I mean,
that's very cool.
I would put it up there with maybe Gallipoli as the best desert, quote unquote, desert films that I've seen, like war films.
What's Gallipoli?
Gallipoli is
Gallipoli.
The Battle of Gallipoli was in World War I. Was
okay.
And Australian forces. They got absolutely. They were fighting the Turks in that region, and it was I think it's the heaviest losses Australia's ever experienced. I think they lost that battle, but it was Mel Gibson's like breakthrough role. It's Peter Weir. He did Truman Show, Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Did he do Master and Commander?
Yeah.
Fuck.
Gallipoli's incredible. Anyways, it's about a friendship between two soldiers. But anyways, Warfare is the best Iraq-based war film I've seen.
This is
fucking amazing,
and the reason is they brought in consultants and the guys that sort of co-wrote, co-directed the film.
Yeah, Ray Mendoza.
There's a guy called Ray Mendoza who I can only assume is a veteran.
Yeah, so this is based on
and
an
this is
a mission
experience that he was in. Right?
And so this is based on all the collective memory of those that have survived this afternoon, this particular mission.
Yeah,
and it's fascinating in the sense that. I had a very interesting experience watching this, and I think it would be nice to talk about this with you guys, where I was like, who is this movie for?
Yeah.
Like, who would really appreciate this movie? I think anyone could enjoy watching it, but I was like, who could really appreciate this? And I realized, I think anyone who has a respect and interest in warfare and guns, not the MAGA-toting fucking Second Amendment fucking heck. I'm talking about someone who like plays like Call of Duty, who plays Airsoft. Because what you get from this movie is you get this incredible sense of how these young men, who are not necessarily the most academic or the most smart or the most promising individuals in the world, those are guys that go off and build careers for themselves in America. Yeah. These are, you know, traditionally you find someone a bit hard on their luck joining the military. Because that's the sort of
that's where the system works.
So they're not necessarily the most pedigree individuals, but they learn this code and they learn the smarts of how to conduct these missions. And I think it's fascinating to watch in this movie how they communicate and how they have to run these operations, how they speak, how they conduct the etiquette, the code, that's very cool to watch. And there are moments when warfare can be boring. You got to sit and do nothing.
Jarhead, great example.
Jarhead's a great example. Yeah. But there's a moment in this movie, and don't be put off, where the movie actually gets a little bit boring in the beginning, but that's kind of on purpose.
Yeah.
Just for a little bit. And then, of course, things heighten.
So our Saints parent, while we were watching it, when it goes wrong and there are moments of stillness after that, like no still moment feels safe.
Yeah, exactly.
No, after that. So your anxiety doesn't stop just because nothing's happening.
Yeah.
Because you get the sense that it can go wrong at any second.
Yeah.
And that's what the space is like for these soldiers. Like there's no peace.
I agree.
Right?
Yeah. I think that's the benefit of it, of not having any music whatsoever. As well, the only music we get is the end credits and the beginning.
Yes, but have we mentioned that it's all in real time? I don't think we have.
Yeah, so we haven't.
Yeah. That's like the big thing, is that it's happening second for second.
And so the fascinating thing about that film, so Ray Mendoza, he was the combat consultant on Civil War with Alex Garland, which came out last year. And the combat in that was fucking incredible, right? And him and Alex Garland became friends, and then he started telling Garland about like one of his failed missions. And Garland was like, fuck, that'd make a great movie. And the guy, I think he's actually the guy on the poster, he's from Shogun. He is one of the guys who like gets his legs blown off in the movie, right?
Yeah.
And so it's all based on real people, and it's interesting in the credits, you'll see they show side by sides of people, but a lot of their faces are blurred.
Yeah.
Right? And there's very few that are actually willing to talk about it. So the main guy who got his legs blown off, he doesn't remember a thing about what happened. So that's when Ray Mendoza actually decided, okay, cool, I'm going to go chat to all the guys that were on the mission with me and get a collected memory of what it was like for all of them. So, and they say that at the beginning of the film, in text it says, these are everyone's memories. This is based on memory, right? So it's interesting because it's a real time. I mean, there's so many moments where they're like, cool, evac is coming in 2 minutes, and then it changes to 5 minutes, and then it changes to 7 minutes, and then it goes away completely. And it's so tense with not having any music. It's like No Country for Old Men. The tension is always at a high because there's no music.
Yeah.
It's not telling you how to feel or when to expect something. And then that's why the jump scares, quote-unquote jump scares, work so hard, because it just happens out of the blue.
Yeah, you know, no, I mean? It was...
You're expecting it, but you don't know when.
Rocked out of my seat in some of those
moments.
That first IED explosion.
Yeah, Jesus.
And so that's why it is important to mention that we are screening it at the Bioscope. But if not the Bioscope, watch it in a cinema, because the
biggest
sound...
Biggest, loudest, yeah.
The sound is amazing.
It's so hard. I mean, look, it's not hard for a war film to make you feel like you're there. So many war films have done that effectively, right? But this one, this is the most interesting. I've never seen a war film like this, because it feels so fucking real. There's no... we don't see any, like, hoorah America moments, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, I was telling Cole afterwards, like, I think there were only like 3 deaths in that whole movie. Like, most of it was missed shots. Most of it was like just, oh, we're skirmishing. Okay, no, we actually got to stop because we're going to die. Like, yes, we should pull back now. Like, there's no hurrah heroic moments. Nothing feels it doesn't.
Doesn't have this kind of propaganda agenda.
It doesn't glorify war at all.
Well, this is what I want to chat about, is that without giving much away, and I don't think this gives much away, I think it's part of what enriches the conversation around this film, is that when this movie ends, you feel, fuck, that was kind of pointless.
Yeah.
Like, what was the point of all that fucking pain?
It rattled
me. And all of that, because you got the sense when the movie ended that, like, fuck, life just goes on.
Exactly.
And it's like,
last shot,
this one afternoon of absolute agony and trauma and squirmish, just fucking
screaming,
was just one fucking random afternoon in this little neighborhood in Iraq, and life fucking goes on.
Exactly.
This is one of thousands of missions.
Yeah.
And so you're like, what's the fucking point of war? And I was like, okay, this is cool. It's a critique. It's a critique. And then the credits start, and you're like, but there is a bit of rah-rah here, because now we're going to glorify these, not glorify, but we're going to honor and celebrate these guys that were part of this mission. So it like I then left it going, wait, is this a fucking anti-war?
I think so as well.
It's about the people. It's about the sacrifice that you make to defend a nation. I don't think it's about nationalism.
Yeah, sure. I agree. I think the whole point as well is to show, because it's no secret at the moment that veterans in America get treated like shit. And the whole point, I feel, of this film is that if you're going to send these boys, these young men into war, you have to fucking look after them when it's over.
Yeah.
Because that's the point, is a lot of these veterans get treated like shit. Vietnam veterans famously treated like shit.
Yeah.
They were hated by the public and they were not cared about by the government because it was such a fruitless, awful war that no one wanted.
Right, you know what I mean? It was projected onto the soldiers that returned.
You know, the suits wanted it because communism bad, even though the Vietnamese were just fighting for fucking freedom, independence.
No, sure. We all know that it was a tricky one. But
interesting.
I found that yo-yo at the end very interesting.
Yes.
And so that's when I was like, fuck, I don't know whether you could screen this movie to a bleeding heart liberal because it does get a little celebratory at the end or honoring of war.
Yeah.
No, I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And so I was like, who ultimately would love this movie? And then I realized, like, the few individuals I know who enjoy shooting guns that hold and carry are actually very respectful. They are the safest, smartest kind of dudes I know.
Okay, right.
They're not wild guys. I mean, obviously there's definitely people that fucking abuse it.
Yeah.
But the people who I know that enjoy like Call of Duty, that enjoy Airsoft, that they're smart, interesting, also very left-leaning individuals. So I was like, I think you would enjoy that movie.
Mm.
So I've got one individual in particular, a good friend of mine, and I was like, share this with your gun club. Like, come and watch this movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I think you guys would appreciate how fucking authentic it is.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, Raymond Doza even said, like, because you were saying, who is this made for? And he actually said, for him and the guys that he served that mission with, he said it's been almost like
therapy.
Cathartic. Yeah, because they all are finally accepting what happened. They're finally, like, coming to terms with, like, that was fucked up. Holy shit. You know what I mean? Because, like, the soundtrack, most of the soundtrack is two men screaming in agony the whole movie. And what I love about it as well, the fog of war moment when that first explosion happens, it's so slow and it feels like a lifetime because it must have felt like a lifetime for them.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And that's why it's so effective. That whole sequence is shot and cut like a horror film.
Yeah.
And it's just,
and it's so
terrifying.
It's very cool. It's very cool to see their operation and how one part of their operation involves requesting a show of force.
Yeah. Oh, that jet.
Holy
shit. And they're like, we need a show of force. And we need this to happen just before we're trying to get out to...
So that they, out like of everyone the, that hears it hides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
And you sort of wonder what a show of force is. It happens so quickly. And that's a jet flying over the street that just causes this
storm of sand.
And of course, that is another thing that you love to see and hear in a cinema because it's just this incredible whoosh of this jet. Oh, it's cool.
It's
we need
amazing.
A show of force. Okay, and the guy's like, okay, I'm coming in for a show of force. And you just see this.
One last thing. Like, I also love the it feels real as well because there's like moments where like guys are like rattled and it doesn't feel the same way in other war movies. So there'll be an instance where one of the guys who's played by James Gandolfini's son, Michael Gandolfini, where he tries to put the morphine into one of the guy's legs, but he fucks up and he injects himself by accident.
Yeah,
like
he had it the wrong
he's
way
like,
around.
Fuck. And then even like the one thing that was like, holy shit, this is like feels real, is when Will Porter is speaking to Charles Melton and he's like, dude, I'm fucked up. You have to take over. And because he's like the squad leader.
Yeah, he's meant to be the main communicator and he's
and
unable
it's also,
to.
After that explosion, his throat, the whole movie, he was like struggling to speak because like everything
it was just
like,
tensing.
Yeah, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it does
a
good job of getting across the sheer panic and anxiety that goes on. But then it's also interesting in the war environments to see how compass mentis you have to be.
Yeah.
To like coordinate yourself and other people to keep them alive.
Dude. Yeah.
And you're sitting there thinking, this is unreasonable as fuck. This is
yeah.
But also, like you say, as a commentary, I knew this before, but this film made it even more certain for me in that it doesn't glorify war. It's not a film about nationalism. Because I watch this and I'm like, I am never fucking picking up a gun for a country
exactly,
in my life.
Yeah.
It's never happening.
It is ultimately frivolous. You do feel that at the end.
It's like a waste of life.
They need that structure. They need that protocol. So like whenever it was the counting down to when they have to leave the house.
Yeah.
And the scariest thing they have to do is walk out the front door and get in a car in the road.
That was like 10 meters away.
That was 10 meters away. That's basically the movie. It's like, how do we get into that car?
And
that
not
car,
die.
That car is an armored vehicle. Once we're in that, we're safe. But between the door and the road, and their protocol is that show of force, which we spoke about, like the gas that's going to add sort of
suppression fire.
And when they're counting down this evac, they all repeat it. It's like, evac 2 minutes, and everyone goes, 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And they're like, you can just see they're all getting them fucking like themselves ready.
Well, I mean, that's I think that opening scene as well, it's such a jarring difference to the rest of the film, because the opening scene is it's got that Call on Me song from the 2000s.
It's all of them watching a music video that was a particularly sexual music video.
Yeah, I remember it started, and I thought I was watching a trailer for The Substance.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You're like, hey, they're bringing
the exercise
it
video.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's interesting. Because everything that like I read about, Raymond Doza said before every mission, they would watch that as like a ritual. Every mission.
Right.
Interesting.
And it would get them hyped up. And like, it's interesting because that's the only two instances of music is that and a song by Low at the end of the film, which is a great track. And it just works so well that there's no music. And the audience was in it when we watched it. The whole audience were fucking in it. And it's just such a compelling film. It's a film where so much happens, but so little happens as well. Very little gets accomplished. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. All right. So, so that's Warfare. Warfare is in cinemas, including the Bioscope. Another movie coming out this Friday, around the world, 18th of April, around the world, is Sinners.
Ah.
So let's talk about Sinners for a moment. Yeah. You guys haven't had a chance to watch it.
No.
And I went and I fucking loved it.
Yeah?
I loved it. Okay, so let's just talk for a moment. This is directed by Ryan Coogler, who, Perrin, you got a little bit more experience. We all watched Black Panther.
Yeah.
Some of us have watched Creed. Those are the more sort of bigger, more popular films. But you've been there since...
Yeah, Fruitvale Station, which is... Well, I think it's his first film. He did it with Michael B. Jordan. And it's about a real event of police brutality that happened on like at a station in LA, I think.
Interesting.
And yeah, it's been a while since I've seen it, but it's a great like small tense film. It's really, really
good. It's nice when you can bring
based
your
on a true story, by the way.
Yeah, I hear this all the time in my world, especially in and around the Joburg Film Festival, where if we were playing a drinking game where we took a sip every time someone on a microphone said it's important we tell our stories, we would all be fucked up.
Yes,
but it's cool when this happens. It's great. Not to say that it doesn't happen at the Joburg Film Festival, it's just that's a thing we hear, right?
Yes.
Especially in South Africa, we got to tell our stories. So it's really great when someone does that successfully.
Yes.
And so Sinners stars two Michael B. Jordans. It was originally meant to be Jonathan Majors, who cataclysmically fucked up his whole career.
Wow.
And so now you've got these two twins. They're called the Smokestack Twins.
So is it just going to be brothers initially? Or like non-identical twins, maybe?
Maybe. They're called the Smokestack Twins. One of them's called Smoke and the other one's called Stack.
Sick.
And they are these two gangsters that have returned back to their hometown. We are in 1930s Southern states of America.
Okay.
This is like...
Why have they returned home?
They want to open up a juke joint. So the whole movie is...
Takes place there.
Takes place over the course of this afternoon and nighttime.
Juke joint, like a party place.
Yeah. So they
it's like a shebeen.
It's a shebeen. It's effectively a shebeen. And they manage to get this old mill, and it's all about them setting up this party, this night, the opening night.
Okay.
We're talking like kind of like tuk-tuk, kind of like Ford old cars. Yeah. But 1930s is just this incredible era of like blues music, this particular kind of music. And so this movie starts with this like very rich fabric of like what it means to be black in America in 1930s.
Right. Yeah, Jim Crow era.
Jim Crow era. And they.
It's like Prohibition era as well.
Yeah, 30s. Yeah.
And Ku Klux Klan is fucking still rife.
Yes, yes.
Going strong.
Fuck's sake.
You get introduced to this idea that throughout history, there are people that through music are able to channel the other worlds, right? They can bring the dead. They can they can channel something. They can transcend where they are. You know, in Africa, they were called witch doctors. In the where they were the rain men, or you know, whatever. These people throughout history are able to do that, and so they play on this idea of like this other world. But for the most part, the first half of the movie actually plays out like a little bit of a like Oscar-y, art house-y, Toni Morrison book that's been adapted. So it's like it's got this kind of rich fabric in the beginning. Okay. And then the nighttime comes.
Oh.
And I actually saw the word today in an IndieWire review that can actually announce it. It becomes a vampire movie.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
So
it's a vampire movie. I did not get that.
So this is what's fucking awesome is that you've got this.
I thought it was like supernatural. No. Or
they
like
always
zombies.
Said supernatural horror, but they actually play in the world of vampire. And what's so smart is that because you've got this culturally rich story, it can feel important as this product made by a black filmmaker, but it can still be this like really cool, fun night.
Right.
For you in the cinema.
Right.
Where it's like it turns into a popcorn movie. It's both. It manages to be both at the same time.
And it does it well. It doesn't feel like two different movies.
I think it's fucking rad. And Graham, who's the other member of our podcast team, unlike Exposed Genitals, his thing that he latches onto is a big swing. And there's one or two moments where they have these like big swings where they embrace this idea of culture and history and time.
Love that.
Through music. And there are these moments that just like they just sweep you in terms of music, and you become a bit entranced through music where you're like, this is a big swing, but it's fucking cool.
I'm pumped for it. It looks so stunning. Good.
Yeah. But then there's a couple of like moments. Like you love Cole.
Yeah.
You love the jump scares.
Yes.
There's a couple of cool fucking vampire jump scares.
It sounds sick. Like a good From Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what it sounds like as well? Is I'm busy reading Salem's Lot by Stephen King.
Oh, cool.
Okay, what's that like?
And he spends half the book talking about the town and the villages.
Okay.
So there's nothing that happens. There's hints of something happening. You don't know what's happening. You know there's an abduction. You start seeing the signs of vampirism. But that's happening like 40% into the book. The rest of the time is just setting up people going about their small little town vibes. Yeah.
It's kind of in that realm.
And then all of a sudden it goes to shit. It was like today's the day that Salem died. And you're like, fuck. And then you see everyone like missing. Because the vampires start to exponentially take over. And there are like three adaptations of it that I really want to watch. And this sounds like an interesting continuity in that.
It's sounding very similar.
Okay.
In a very cool way.
That's fucking cool. But, I'm excited.
But with really cool blues music.
Sick. Fuck yeah.
Like that's always the best
like
thing I remember.
Heartfelt fucking like this is the enormity and significance of this music. It's not just like a blues chord, like, hey, my lady left me, like, It's not that. It shows the power of music in a way. Without it being the forefront, it just shows you that there's just something behind it.
And I'm
so grateful that I did do the English lit that I did at Varsity, right? Because I got exposed to a bunch of books that I wouldn't have normally read.
Right.
And I'm not going to call myself in any way as an expert because I've only read like two of them. But a woman like Toni Morrison.
Love Toni Morrison.
Wrote some really incredible books. I read.
Star. Jesus.
I read Sula and Song of Solomon.
Yeah. Her second novel.
In those books, there's this idea of magical realism where she'd say, you know, Daddy flew away. like, as in he like left, right?
Right.
At a young age. But the book would talk about how his feet left the ground and he sailed off into the sky. Like he was able to fly, but he flew away. And it's like, and it's just this idea of it, like it's rooted in some realism, but it's this fantastical folklore that was very rich and prevalent in that era, where you were still bringing in your African slave heritage, and you were still living in this crazy time, and you were still trying to figure out so many civil rights and like,
It reminds me of Beloved. Beloved is another one of her books, and that's that's kind of about haunting, but it's not literal haunting as in a ghost, but there's still something like when death happens in a place, it's the spirit of that thing holds it, and that place has changed for you, right?
And the
way she uses ideas and words like that.
The first vampires, the first evil that we're seeing happen to be white people that come to the door of this juke joint where the black folks are inside, the white guys are outside, and they want to come in. It's like the evil. It's like, can you let the evil in?
Yes.
And how this evil will ultimately infect your utopia that you're trying to create, even if it's just for one night.
Right.
You're trying to build your life in your town. You're trying to build your world, and in comes
Ryan
this evil.
Coogler, I love this.
You
mentioned like that you were grateful that you studied lit at university. Yeah. I'm sorry to bring up After Theory to anyone listening who's not interested, but one thing that they taught us that the students could never get whenever I marked, because I spent a lot of time marking scripts and like director's treatments.
After studying, you lectured a bit.
Yeah. And they taught us this theory called specific relevance, right? And it's, you can have like the plot and the story and your general theme about life, but then like tying this to a place and a time is specific relevance. And it's this thing that puts it in an epoch, that makes it of that time, that makes it special, that makes it unique. And like people are often unable to identify that point. It's like a pinpoint. It's so specific. And you can hear in you describing this, that what makes it different to like a Salem's Lot, that's an assumption, is that it's you when you were pitching it to us, you were so specific about when it happened, where it happened,
exactly,
what the energy was, what the restrictions were, who they were, what they were trying to do. And it's like, you can't do that at any other points in time in history, right? It's specific to America, and that's what makes it special, right?
Especially Jim Crow era.
Like, and then that unlocks all this like layered meaning.
Exactly.
It's not just a vampire movie, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's what makes it different.
That's it. Well said. But yeah, so that's Sinners. That starts this Friday at the Bioscope in cinemas around the world.
Yeah. I watched Minecraft.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Is that a German film?
Is that culturally rich?
All I'm going to say is there's a line where Jack Block says, let's craft, let's mine, let's Minecraft.
Oh God!
Yeah, that's the script writing in this movie. It's Jack Black also saying a lot of Minecraft stuff, like fit and steel. Like what I do like is Jack Black's commitments to being Jack Black. Ultimately, it's
He never phones it in,
and that's like,
I think
kind
if
of
he
admirable.
Ever, if he ever did, we'd know it was the beginning of the end.
But where did this sudden hatred for Jack Black start coming from?
I'm not feeling any hate.
Because, no, dude, like,
my
everywhere online, everyone's like, oh, Jack Black, I'm not going to watch any movie with Jack Black.
No, that's just because these folks get so famous that these things happen.
Yeah, exactly. He's at that point where you're going to have haters and people.
No, I don't think that's worth a mention.
No, but...
What the fuck is this movie? Because, okay, perhaps let's just quickly touch on, what is Minecraft?
So Minecraft is a sandbox game. Okay. And what that means is that you have an open world that you can navigate. You can do anything you want. It's not particularly goal directed or like story directed in the sense.
Yeah.
But you can take apart the world by mining it, and you can combine those elements to create things. And what it has become is this place where young people have unlocked an exploration of creativity in gaming that hadn't been seen really beforehand. Right?
Yeah. I think it's worth mentioning that it it is a very good, productive game.
Yeah.
When problem solving. When the world and the parents and the community says it's rotting our kids' minds, this is not one of those games.
It's not one of those games at all.
This is not a silly game. This is a smart.
Yeah.
A smart game, and
especially
which is why
Lego.
Is why it's been so successful as a game. It's probably one.
It's
of
actually
the
a
most,
really good comparison.
Yeah, it's
like
Lego on computer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's exactly what it is.
And here comes a movie that I think for the most part. People were unsure of, a little bit skeptical of, almost mocking of, and it's worth mentioning that it's been the first big hit of 2025.
Yeah, it's massive.
Around the world, Minecraft has exceeded everyone's expectations.
Yeah, globally,
as a movie.
It launched like $300 million.
It's the big swing that GeForce knows and likes, and it fucking paid off.
Yeah.
It happened. Despite,
I don't know if it's a big swing, because it's like a particularly established property.
Okay.
I think maybe... I wouldn't call it a big swing, actually.
No.
Because I think they're
maybe
doing
not as a
really
movie.
Obvious.
It's a big swing, but it's not a big swing, but a big result for such a small swing.
For such a like
so it
a
became,
lazy.
It became bigger. It was it exceeded everyone's expectations. Is the movie good?
No.
Okay.
It's like I thought about it when I wrote it on a Letterboxd. I said that we have the page master at home.
Yeah,
you know, the Macaulay Culkin kind of movie from the 90s.
Yeah, exactly. I was kind of just, this does that, or that does this a little bit better and is a little bit more emotional. It has that, like, what you were talking about earlier with the comedies, like Wedding Crashers and whatever.
Yeah.
It has that thing that roots you, like, in a story. Minecraft just doesn't have that. It's a really good lesson in bad script writing where you have superfluous characters that add nothing into the story and they should be put on the cutting room floor.
So why do you think it was so successful? Because the game is so successful and timing?
I think because Minecraft is so about so much more than Minecraft.
Okay. And what's the chicken sausage or the chicken...
chicken jockey.
Chicken jockey.
What
See,
is
like,
that?
That's a really good thing to try and identify where we sit here as older people and we're like, why is this so fucking funny? Why is this such a moment?
What is the chicken jockey?
It's, I guess it's something in Minecraft where a little zombie child...
Yeah.
Basically, because you get zombies that come alive at night and try to kill you in the game. So a zombie child rides a chicken, and Jason like Momoa fast, is fighting one of these things zombie. In a ring.
Yeah, so what happens apparently if I think it's programmed into the game where if that happens, if a chicken jockey happens, it's not a good thing for you as a gamer because it's basically the system trying to kick you off now because it's like unkillable. Like it's like super fast and like kills you instantly. So it's almost like the system's like saying, please get off. You've played
long
enough.
It's like a server kick.
I think so, yeah. Which is quite cool. That's why people are losing their shit.
And so then this
extremely rare. That's what it is.
Okay. So then this moment happens in the movie and everyone who knows the in-joke, because they feel like they're a part of this community, they are celebrating this particular moment. It's a memeified moment.
Yes.
And so that's perhaps why this movie's done so well, is that it's got all these kind of in-jokes to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's like Minecraft lives so much more beyond because it's been like 15 years since it released.
Jeez.
Okay.
Right? It's been that
it's
long.
It's about as old as the Bioscope.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's part
of
the zeitgeist now. Yeah.
And yeah, there's so much more going on around it. Like, I don't know, but the story is just like... It's the easiest five script writers like trying to turn this massive property into an A to B story.
Okay.
And it's just it's
okay.
Yeah,
let's not elaborate on it.
But like
it's cool
what I'd say is that like the best Minecraft content you could watch is all on YouTube, and that's where these kids are, right? There's a YouTuber called Dream, and what he does is he speed runs Minecraft. Okay. So there is an objective like within the open world game, and it's to get to a different world called the Nether and to kill something called, and there's a like, it's part of that, I don't know, but then he has to kill the Ender Dragon at the end and then you win Minecraft basically. It's like this creature, and he speedruns that in like sometimes 30 minutes to an hour, okay, which is like kind of fucking insane. That's what's impressive about it. Is the skill, and that's what's entertaining. But the trick is that he has five of his friends trying to kill him at the same time.
So he
has to escape his friends and try and hide in an open world game where you can go anywhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's really fucking fun. Like, if you want to get a glimpse into this Minecraft world in a way that's accessible, I think watch that.
Okay, we'll try and get that link in the description.
Below. It's called Minecraft Manhunt.
Okay.
Awesome.
It's so good.
Yeah.
We've had ourselves a very a very long chat already, but I want to chat a little bit about TV. Can we move on?
Dude.
Yes. Okay.
I want to tell you guys about Dying for Sex.
Ugh, I've heard about that.
Story of my life.
this is the new show on Disney Plus. It stars Michelle Williams. It is based off a podcast of the same name, which is inspired by the life of a woman. It stars, as I said, Michelle Williams, who we all know from many acclaimed Oscar films. Yeah, you'll recognize her instantly. It also stars Jenny.
Just to buy the sea.
Yeah, she's so good. Blue Valentine.
It also stars Jenny Slate, who I'm going to get into.
I love Jenny Slate.
Who is one of those character actors, you know her face immediately, but you don't really know her name. So I'll get into her. But basically, the way I'm going to introduce this TV show to you is the way in which this TV show introduces itself very quickly, very succinctly, and it is a lesson to all writers as to how quickly and effectively, especially the Americans, are so good at introducing TV shows. You don't have episodes and episodes that dwell on this. You know within 10 fucking minutes what this movie is about. I mean, what this TV show is about. A couple sitting in a psychologist's office, and they are talking about the fact that she's not getting what she wants sexually and intimately from her husband.
Okay.
She then gets a call from her doctor that tells her her cancer is back.
Fuck's sake.
So this whole TV show is about a woman who has struggled with cancer, come out of it, and it's reared its head again, this time significantly. But we know that she's lived this somewhat conservative life with a husband that hasn't satisfied her sexually, where that becomes something bigger than just, you know, occasional pump on the side. Like,
yes.
This is, you know, she's missed out on so much passion and love and intimacy and joy and fuck everything that an orgasm represents, right?
Mm. Yeah.
And so the show is about her kind of finding her sexuality and through that finding her confidence. So she learns, she ultimately leaves her husband. I'm not giving too much away, but you then go on this journey with her where not only do you have the tragedy of her imminent death, because this is incurable cancer, like this is, and she needs lots of appointments and doctor's appointments and procedures and things, but she is also trying to find some joy in life. It reminded me a lot of another TV show, which is over on Netflix, which we spoke about years ago, which was called How to Build a Sex Room.
Oh, you loved this.
Which is one of the better gems in that reality TV world, because it has you question your own desire and your own sort of understanding of sex and what you would ultimately want from joy and pleasure and who you are and what you want.
Yes.
Because this ultimately comes down to this woman going, well, what do you want? The moment you know what you want, you can ask for it. So she was always so quiet, so in the shadow of her husband who looked after her when she first had cancer, that she didn't have a voice, where she now goes, I want this to make me orgasm. And through that, she can then go, well, I want you to treat me this way in life.
Wow.
So through that exploration, she figures herself out and gets her own confidence. She obviously acts her fucking pants off, literally and figuratively. she's incredible. So Jenny Slate is... she often plays very ridiculous characters. I was first introduced to her as John Ralphio's sister.
Mona Lisa Saperstein.
Mona Lisa Saperstein.
In Parks and Rec.
In Parks and Rec. But she's such a good...
Don't be suspicious.
Don't be suspicious.
Money, please.
Yeah, money, please.
Yeah.
She's a really good actress.
Amazing.
She's the voice of Marcel the Shell.
No way.
Yeah.
Hi.
With shoes on.
Yeah. With shoes on.
No, it's great. It's also one of those shows, it's worth mentioning, that after watching like two episodes, you kind of want to give it a break, but in a good way.
Okay.
Yeah. Like it is quite a heavy show. So
it's like Severance for me.
So like, it's like it's on your night. It's not a bingeable show. It's not an easy binge.
Okay.
It's a take your time with it.
Are all episodes out? Is it a mini series?
It is. No, it's a... ongoing
series.
It's an ongoing series. Okay. I think it will be limited. Oh. But it is coming out an episode at a time. I'm enjoying that over on Disney Plus.
Okay.
Tracker, Dr. Odyssey, Will Trent. They're all coming out like kind of an episode at a time.
Yeah, it's very cool.
I love how if you go over to Netflix now, they're celebrating the fact that some of their shows are live. And it's like, congratulations, you've just gone fucking full circle.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, oh, you've invented like live TV. Yeah. Well, yes. Well done. We had that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now they've got these game shows that are happening live.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, cool. But yeah, Dying for Sex on Disney Plus. Definitely worth it, along with How to Build a Sex Room over on
Netflix.
On Netflix, which just is a quick back of the box. Is this delightful old woman. She's this like woman in her 60s that basically deals with different people in every episode, all different kinds of love, whether it's just two parents that have lost all intimacy because their house is full of kid shit, down to swingers that want to build a big orgy room,
fuck yeah,
to people with all sorts of kinks, to just a woman that's now single that wants to bring men home. She designs a room that fits their sexual desires, that has a couple of toys in the drawer or a giant big fucking swing in their dungeon. Like, she builds these sex rooms. It's fucking a great show.
Amazing.
Awesome.
It's probably one of my quick go-to, like, you'd fucking love this. Everyone would love this movie. And ultimately, you should watch it with your partner.
Ugh.
No, you should, because you can together go like, oh, that's not me.
That's not for me. Like, no, but I want. What's
like,
that like?
I could
do that.
I could.
You want to do that to me?
Yeah. I could get into that.
Yeah.
So yeah, Lekker, we finished The Residence, which is that big whodunit on Netflix.
Mm. Oh, cool!
In the White House.
In the White House, it's the Shondaland production. You know, which is the woman who did Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah.
Shonda Rhimes. Who also, a little bit like Ryan Coogler, has a really important agenda, which is representation. Right. That's why there are black people in Bridgerton. Because she is going, fuck that.
Yeah.
Let's change history just in this fun way and have a black queen in old English times.
Yeah.
And why the fuck does it have to just be a bunch of white people?
Yeah.
Exactly. So here we have a black detective who also loves birding.
I love that.
My one criticism of the show is that it's 8 episodes. It could have probably been 6.
Yeah.
There were a couple of episodes that just felt a bit tedious.
Okay.
But it is a lovely, cool whodunit with great little twists and turns.
Mm.
It's got that ability in each episode to have you believe it's a different person each time. So really, up until right at the end, you don't know who it is.
Mm.
And it's a lovely kind of final thing.
Cool.
I realize that often with these whodunits, you can only get somewhat of an anticlimactic ending because you've built it up for so long.
Yeah.
But this is still cool. And it was just nice to just see a different kind of
detective
at the helm here, not just an old white guy. So no, it was a good watch. That's The Residence on Netflix.
Cool.
Nice.
Is there anything else that you guys are dying to chat about?
I started Black Mirror last night.
Yeah, I also started that. Did you start the first episode?
Yeah, Common People.
Yeah,
really interesting. The thing with Black Mirror is I know I'm going to get shots for this, but I find it very hit and miss.
Mm.
So like it's either really phenomenal, super cringy, or just like bad, right? So like this first episode is phenomenal though. It's Rashida Jones and the guy from IT Crowd. What's his name?
Irish actor. Dad.
Yeah. And
it's very cool.
It's the premise of the first episode that we watched is that she like has a stroke, but there's like a part of her brain that like the stroke happened there, right? And she might not ever wake up, but a tech company approaches the husband, which is Chris O'Dowd, and is like, listen, we can remove that, replace that with like a tech piece of brain or whatever.
It's Elon Musk's new startup. Yeah. It's that idea where like you can put a chip in your brain that can spark it's called Neuralink, right?
Yeah.
Right. And it's definitely inspired by that.
Yeah,
which is like,
so they were like,
put this thing in her brain.
Yeah, so
they're
like
killing animals all the time in the series as well. Like no.
Yeah, so like, so that part, they like upload that part to like the cloud, and then you with the streaming a subscription service, you can access that and she'll be fine.
She says the surgery is free, but you just got to pay a monthly subscription
$300.
And they and you get the sense that they're not a wealthy, successful couple. They've got to work quite hard. She's a teacher. He's like in this kind of blue collar welder. And it's all about that and the reliance on that, because then the pressures to keep the service going, and how we're kind of reliant on technology. It's cool.
Yeah, and then the subscription changes. They'll be like, oh no, you're on the common plan. So like every now and then she'll just start saying adverts out loud.
Oh my
god.
And she doesn't even know she's saying them. Yeah,
so it like affects her work and stuff. And it's really funny in large parts, and then it just gets really like unsettling and like disturbing and like just depressing, because it's an obvious critique on healthcare in America, you know, where like if you can't afford healthcare, you are fucked in America. You're dead, basically. You can't afford to live. You know what I mean?
Right. So you're right. It's far more about healthcare than it is about technology.
But I'm excited for the rest of the series. I've only heard good things about it. That season, I mean. But yeah, started that. Last of Us has started. I'm fucking so excited for that.
Oh, has it started?
Yeah, season two just started
last
night.
So Black Mirror is obviously on Netflix. Last of Us is?
They'll be on Showmax locally, yeah. Because the second game is probably the greatest like story I've ever played in a video game. So I'm very excited to see.
Oh, there actually is a second video game that has its own narrative.
So season two's... Two and three are going to cover the second game, because the second game is massive and it's just fucking relentless and tragic and just incredible. It's just jaw-dropping storytelling.
Is it only on PS5?
I think it's been ported to... It was PS4 initially. That was like the last game on that.
That means I can play it.
But it's PS4, PS5. I think it's just been ported to the PC now.
Okay.
But yeah, I can't... Neckbeards hated that game because representation is awful to them.
Yeah, they don't want to see women in video games
anymore. Yeah, and also, I wouldn't have done it that way. Well, they don't owe you shit, okay?
Exactly.
It's fucking great storytelling, and the I'm excited to see how people are going to react to the same beats in the series. Because,
it's going to
be fucking relentless. Jesus.
Lovely, man.
Yeah, but anyways.
Cool. Well, listen, guys. It's been a lovely chat.
It was a good chat. It was a good one.
It was a goodie. Yeah. It got some heart.
Yeah.
Even the chat got that heart that we spoke about, which was cool.
This episode was written by Owen
Wilson. Co-written.
Yeah.
Lovely. Our home store is the videostore.co.za. That's our home base. And there's all links to other guest episodes and all other stuff. But please chime in. Let us know what you've been enjoying and what you think about the shows that we've chatted about today. All right. Thank you, Cole. Thank you, Perrin. Thank you for all the others browsing the shelves, listening up until now. Let's get the fuck out of here.
Let's go.
All right. See you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.